In the next Rare Well Done, the Thrive team helps two people with CIDP tackle the tricky issue of friendship.
Hello.
They say the quiet part out loud.
In the event my CIDP worsens, my friends might decide it's too much.
Get nudged outside their comfort zone.
I don't know if I want to.
To forge stronger connections.
It's the best thing that's ever happened to me, our friendship.
To Rory.
Watch Rory and Michelle take on the friendship factor on the next episode of Rare Well Done.
Keep cool this summer when you shop ceiling fans at Menards. Upgrade your space with a quick install ceiling fan from Patriot Lighting. They're loaded with extra features that will make your ceiling fan install a breeze. Plus, they reduce energy costs, helping you save time and money. Save big on our great selection of ceiling fans. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
This summer, whatever you're watching, baseball, golf, soccer, racing, DraftKings has you covered for every single moment of it. The DraftKings Sports app is now available in all 50 states, bringing the game straight to your fingertips wherever you are. New DraftKings customers, sign up with code KSR, spend $5 to get 150 in rewards within 14 days. Includes all markets. That's code KSR. In partnership with DraftKings, the crown is yours. Bet with DK Sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 1-800-MY-RESET. Connecticut? Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino in Kansas, bet tax pass-through may apply in Illinois. 21 plus, void in Canada. Event contract trading with DraftKings predictions involves risk of loss. Availability varies. Predictions offer void in New York. Bet to get bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Trade to get prediction dollars that expire in 1 year. $50 in rewards issued every 7 days via click to claim for 14 days. One non-withdrawable reward redeemable. Terms at dkng.co/offer. Limited time offer.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Jennifer Stratton told the jury she used her thumbs. She's a Duxbury firefighter and paramedic, and on the night of January 24th of 2023, she ended up in the basement of a house on Summer Street doing chest compressions on an eight-month-old baby named Callan Clancy. You don't use your palms on a baby that size. You use your thumbs. That's the technique. And she said it out loud in the courtroom in Plymouth because the prosecutor asked her to describe what she did. Kevin Reddington objected to her describing it. Judge William Sullivan let her answer. That exchange took about 15 seconds on the third day of testimony in Lindsay Clancy's murder trial. And it settled more about how this case is being tried than anything else in the room. Reddington wasn't objecting to the fact. He's never disputed the fact. He was objecting to a jury having to sit inside it. He lost. He was always going to lose it. He's already lost the bigger version of that same argument before the trial started, and he'd lose it twice more before lunch. What you need going in is less than you'd think, because the strange thing about this trial is how little of it is actually contested. Lindsay Clancy is 35. She worked as a labor and delivery nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital. She does not deny that she killed her three children, Cora, who was 5, Dawson, who was 3, and Callan, who was 8 months old. Her own lawyer put it on the record before opening statements. The circumstances of the act, he said, are not in dispute. What's in dispute is her mind. Her defense is lack of criminal responsibility. Her lawyers say she was in postpartum psychosis and that she heard a voice telling her this was her last chance. Prosecutors allege she acted deliberately and meticulously and that she was coherent and functioning in the days before and that she is criminally responsible. A murder conviction means life without parole. Finding of not criminally responsible means committed to a state mental health facility. Two questions, and only one of them is live. The third day of the testimony we spent entirely on the settled one. CBS News Boston counted 10 first responders on the stand that day, officers, firefighters, EMTs, paramedics that came up one after another and told the jury what they walked into. Duxbury officer Stephen Hall was among the first to get there, and he found Lindsay Clancy in the backyard in the snow, drifting in and out of consciousness after going out a second floor window. Hall testified that none of the cuts on her wrists or her neck were actively bleeding. Hold on to that detail. It sounds like scenery. It isn't scenery. On the stand, Hall took his glasses off and wiped his eyes. The Boston Globe reported that he spoke haltingly and struggled to keep his composure. That's 3 years later, under oath in a courtroom in Plymouth. Then he heard Patrick Clancy start screaming from inside the house. Officer Brian Josephine had been dispatched separately, and he was standing over Lindsay in the yard when the screaming started. He and Hall went in. I can't wake them up. I can't get them up, Patrick told them, according to Josephine's testimony. They went down to the basement where Patrick told them what his wife had done. Josephine testified that of the three children, only Callan had a pulse at all, and it was faint. Based on my training experience from previous incidents, I knew it wasn't going to be good, Josephine said. He picked Dawson up chest to chest and carried him out of the house to an ambulance. Then he went back inside, down the stairs again, and took over chest compressions on Cora. Officer Vincent Cahill came in behind him, found Patrick in the basement, and got pointed to the left. Cahill testified that he found two children there, that neither one had a pulse. He started dragging furniture out of the way so the paramedics coming down the stairs would have room to work. Then he did rescue breaths on Cora with a bag valve mask. Later, he was posted at the door to log everybody going in and out. Fire Captain PJ Hussey was working at a 24-hour shift at that moment in time. He was outside the house when he heard a scream, and he looked through a basement window. I saw a male who I now know is Patrick Clancy unwrapping something from a child's head, Hussey testified. He said he learned later that child was Dawson. It turned very chaotic very quickly, Hussey said, as more ambulances came in. Jennifer Staton and her partner, Patrick Dwyer, pulled up to a scene where another crew was already kneeling over Lindsay in the backyard. Somebody yelled at them to get inside. They went to the basement and found Cora and Callan on the floor. Dwyer went to Cora. Stratton went to Callan. Dwyer testified that Cora's skin looked pale. He gave her CPR down there. Tried a defibrillator and went working on her in the ambulance to Beth Israel. Stratton did compressions on Callan with his thumbs. Then, in his own words, she scooped him up in his arms, carried him out of that basement, and rode with him to the hospital. Neither child ever started breathing. Loring Nudd, who goes by Chuck, is retired now. He was a Duxbury firefighter and EMT then. He was pulling a stretcher out of an ambulance in the driveway when an officer came running out of the house carrying Dawson. They put the boy on the stretcher and started CPR. He wasn't breathing. Nudd hauled equipment down to the basement for the other two, then drove the ambulance to the hospital in Plymouth with Dawson in the back. He was on the stand about 10 minutes. Nobody cross-examined him at all. Captain Keith Nettie was off duty that day and got called in because of what it was. He testified that they worked on Dawson with intubation, CPR, epinephrine, and that the boy still had no pulse in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. Somewhere in the middle of all of it, Josephine went back upstairs and found Patrick in the kitchen. He was still frantic, kind of in shock. Josephine testified, still screaming and losing himself. They called for a second ambulance for him. Nobody files a motion about that. There's no ruling to make on it. But the state's own witness, who spent a morning establishing under oath that the house produced more casualties than the three in the basement. The man they were loading into that second ambulance had been on the same witness stand 2 days earlier, describing the same night. Reddington saw all of this coming from a long way off. Before opening statements, he moved to cap it. Once one police officer, one firefighter, one EMT, anything past that, he argued, stops being evidence and starts being volume. Starts being a show. starts being a circus. He was careful about how he said it. He told Sullivan he wasn't trying to minimize the horror of what happened in that house. Piling on responders, he argued, serves no purpose other than to inflame the jury. In the same stretch of argument, he called what the district attorney's office was building a circus. That's a defense attorney doing defense attorney things. And of course, he wants less of this in front of a jury, but he wasn't inventing the problem. He'd sat through the grand jury where, by his account, firefighter after firefighter gave the same rendition of the same scene. He'd also tried to split the trial in two so a jury could decide the act first and the mental health evidence second without one bleeding into the other. And about those same first responders, he said this: what these people went through is just horrific. Sprague's answer was stronger than the defense wanted it to be. She told Sullivan the Commonwealth didn't pick any of this. The Commonwealth did not choose the number of victims. The defendant did, she said. The Commonwealth did not choose the ages of the victims. The defendant did. Trimming the witness list, she argued, doesn't just shorten a mourning. It means dropping the testimony about one of the three children. Then she turned towards Reddington and invited him to tell her which of these children don't matter. Sullivan shut that down on the spot. We don't need that, the judge said. He didn't rule that day. He told both sides he would take it at sidebar and offer on an offer of proof. When the jury came up live in front of the jury, or when it came up live in front of the jury, came up live twice. Mid-morning, prosecutors moved to call another responder. Reddington objected, and Sullivan sent the jury out on a recess while the lawyers argued at the bench. Later, after Josephine stepped down, Reddington renewed the whole motion, and Sullivan took it at sidebar again. The first responders testified. Jennifer Rowan, or Roman, a legal analyst for WBZ, laid out why that ruling holds up, and her reasoning is sound. Their roles were repetitive. Their testimony wasn't. A paramedic, an EMT, a firefighter, a patrol officer, each saw a different slice of the same basement, and each one proved something slightly different for the state. The legal answer and the practical effect don't cancel each other out. 10 people describing the worst thing they ever saw is not a neutral morning. And every lawyer in that room understands exactly what it does to a jury. Both things operated at once in Plymouth Superior Court, and the ruling let them. It's also the answer to why Reddington sat on his hands through most of it. He thanked Officer Hall for his incredible service and sat back down. He told Officer Josephine he had no questions. Nunn walked off the stand without a single question from the defense. It isn't a lawyer asleep at the table. It's a lawyer who already lost the only fight worth having and who knows there's nothing to gain by picking at 10 people the jury has decided that it's going to listen to. But he didn't sit down for all of them, which brings it back to Officer Hall and the cuts that weren't actively bleeding. That was never scenery. Prosecutors worked that thread through responder after responder. Robert Costanzo, a paramedic out of Pembroke, described the injury at her collar as superficial with no active bleeding and bandages on her hands that weren't bleeding either. Daniel Daughtry, a Duxbury firefighter, testified about bandaging the cuts on her wrists while she lay in the backyard. Then Sprague went further than blood. Through her questioning, she put it to the jury that Lindsay Clancy's wrist wounds didn't need to be sutured until the following day and that the wound on her neck never had to be sutured at all. Daughtry wouldn't give it to her. Asked whether he knew the timing on the wrist sutures. He said he didn't get any of that information afterward. Then he was asked whether he knew her neck wound never had to be closed at all. Same answer, Daughtry said. The Boston Globe put the point plainly. Prosecutors have repeatedly highlighted that her wounds weren't bleeding. And the suggestion underneath it is that the attempt on her own life wasn't genuine. This is where Reddington finally stood up. He walked responders through the conditions and got them to agree it was dark at the scene and that on January 24th was a cold winter night in Massachusetts. And the question, you don't know what effects the hypothermia, if any, had on that, would you? The state came right back on redirect. The ambulance was well lit. The hospital was heated. And in both of those places, the responders testified her wounds still didn't bleed heavily. That's a real answer. And it's the strongest version of the state's argument so far. It also asked the jury to believe something enormous. Lindsay Clancy went out a second-story window. She's paralyzed from the waist down. Not exactly superficial injury, permanently. And she was wheeled into that courtroom to sit through this. She's not going to get up and walk out. WBZ's Roman said the staging theory might not land for exactly that reason, and her reasoning is hard to argue with, considering the woman will never walk again. So she didn't cut deep enough over here. Well, she's never going to walk again, and her children are dead. She was in an active, clear state of mind, Massachusetts. Prove it, because that's their burden to prove. A theory that asked 12 strangers to conclude a woman faked the act that put her in a wheelchair for life is a heavy thing to pick up. Prosecutors are entitled to argue it and entitled to test it, but they spent part of the third day of testimony laying pipe for it, and that tells you how much work the intent argument is going to take. It tells you before a single medical expert has been sworn. At 12:07 in the afternoon, Sullivan stopped the day. He told the jury there were a couple of issues he needed to hammer out with both sides, and rather than have them sit around not knowing how long that would run, he sent them home. Christina Rex of WBZ has been in the courtroom every day since the trial reported the reason the prosecution ran out of witnesses. Sullivan told the room the trial is running ahead of schedule. It's running ahead of schedule through the only part of this case nobody is arguing about. The father's testimony is in. The 911 call is in. 10 first responders are in every hour of that. That went to proving an act the defense conceded before the jury was even seated. The actual question in this trial was what was happening in that woman's mind on January 24th of 23. And that question has not yet been put to a single witness. Jury is set to walk through the house on Summer Street next. No photographs. The rooms, lawyers pointing out what they want noted. Jurors standing in the basement in Duxbury and then back to Plymouth to hear whoever the state calls next. They'll take Husey in there with them, a firefighter outside in the dark looking through a basement window at a father working at something around a child's neck, not knowing yet which child he was looking at. Cora was 5, Dawson was 3, Callan was 8 months old. Jennifer Stratton scooped the baby up in her arms, carried him out of that basement, and rode with him all the way to the hospital. She testified that he never got a pulse back. What are your thoughts? Is it getting to be a circus? Running the first responders through all of this? When it's not even in question that she did this? Painting the horror of the day? If you're on the prosecution side, of course you want to do that. But no one's arguing about the horror of the day. That's the thing. No, that's not in question. The horror of the day and what Lindsay's actions put all of these people through who survived it does not get at the question of, was she mentally there? To be criminally responsible. That's the question. Like it or not, that's the question that's being asked. That's what this case is all about. That's going to decide whether she spends the rest of her life in a mental institution or in a prison. So does that evidence offer any sort of valid constructive weight to getting to the determination of whether she was criminally responsible for this. The state has the burden of proving that she was in her right mind. I think that's a hard one to prove. No question of the horror of any of this. And there's really no reason to downplay it, but does it matter for the purpose of what this trial is trying to get at is the question. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. You got to take emotion out of it and really look at the structural pieces to answer that question. You really do. I don't know that I have an answer. I don't know that I because look, if you're going to take it out from one side, and you all know how my feelings are on this, postpartum psychosis, I don't think she was mentally sound in any way, shape, or form. Should she go away to a mental institution for the rest of her life? Without a doubt. And never get out, you know, if that could be an option. I don't think it is technically, but I don't think a prison is the right place either. It's a complicated case, but it's one that hopefully makes us have a deeper conversation about what this is all about, what so many women go through after giving birth to a child that is dismissed, written off. It's just the baby blues. And look, there are versions of that where it is light and not this. And then you get into postpartum depression. And then beyond that, in another ether, it's not like just the next step up from postpartum depression is psychosis. And psychosis is what psychosis is. It's doing things that make no sense at all. Destructive, horrible things that make no sense at all. Seen plenty of cases where people are trying to escape their relationship, their life, their everything, and do horrible things to do that. Lindsay Clancy does not appear to have any sort of plan in that range whatsoever. There's no secret man she wants to run away with. There's no second life that she's building. There's a woman and a brain that are not functioning in a healthy way, and a system that she went to time and 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 time again that put her on drugs, didn't see what the other provider was doing, mixed things that shouldn't be mixed, took her off things that shouldn't be taken off of that quickly and being put on and off. And on top of that, all of the hormones and chemicals that are flowing through her body that are already off balance, mixed with that. And the state wants you to believe that she's just hunky-dory, it's another Tuesday. Everything is fine. Everything is great. Everything will be lovely. You can say it all you want. This is not that. This is not that. Again, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation there. If you want access to trial audio every single day, we bring it to you on our podcast channel. There's the link. There's the QR code. Go to that. Follow us on the podcast platforms, and then you will get all the podcast audio and all of the trial audio every single day. We post it through the day as the trial goes on, gavel to gavel. So if you want to keep up with it in the car, wherever you're going, it's a bit easier to catch it there than necessarily watching it on TV for most folks. We got it for you there in audio form. So do check that out on the podcast. Link is right there. Or just search Hidden Killers wherever you get podcast, or hit the QR code that's right up there. It'll take you. You can choose any podcast platform and take us with you. All right. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Out at McDonald's, te puedes llevar un $5 McChicken meal deal o un $6 McDouble meal deal. Así hay algo para todos. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu meal deal. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.